the white powder, Lawrence. Never really even knew about it until I interviewed you about a year ago. And it just was one of those things that constantly, literally blew my mind. Tell us about that.
Well, the powder, as we spoke about some time back, and I have to say that following that interview, I think I got more email correspondence from a single radio interview than I've ever had about anything else.
It's a powerful
program.
The
interest in this white powder has been quite astonishing. And in fact, it was what my current book, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, is based on. It's the main catalyst for the book.
Mm-hmm.
The stories of the white powder really date from the earliest times on record in ancient Sumer, Akkad, Babylonia. They move through biblical literature, they move into alchemical treatises in the Middle Ages, and then come right up to the days of modern science. And as we spoke of before, it's been progressed now into the sort of area of nuclear physics and astrophysics and whatever. It's a pretty remarkable substance. It had all sorts of names in the past. It was called Highwood Firestone in Mesopotamia. The Israelites simply called it What Is It? They didn't have a real name for it, What Is It? Which is where the word manna comes from. In biblical terms, I mean, it ties in again with the Ark of the Covenant story with Moses at Mount Sinai, having brought the Israelites out of Egypt. And there's a weird little story there which says that Moses got terribly disgruntled when he discovered that his brother had made a golden calf for the Israelites to worship. He'd collected up their earrings and melted them down and made the calf. And then it explains that Moses took the calf, he confiscated it, and said, we'll have no more of this. We've got another god now. And it says he burnt the calf, the golden calf, with fire. He transposed it into a powder, he mixed it with water, and he fed it to the Israelites. Now, this really was quite an odd situation, and not many theologians have queried it over the years. But
right.
The fact is, if you heat or burn gold with fire, you get molten gold. You don't get powder.
Exactly.
At least so it was thought until modern times, and it's now been discovered that, in fact, through various heating processes, through electronic arcing processes, through chemical processes, there are, in fact, about 9 or 10 ways now that I know of that one can actually take gold or any of the platinum group metals, the transition group metals, and transform them into a powder. And this powder has very remarkable qualities. The first thing that happens is that it does not, from that moment, analyze as metal at all. It analyzes all sorts of things except the metal that it actually is. It's fallen apart
into a double
atom state.
Yeah, strange all by itself for that to happen.
That's right. I mean, it's an element that now is completely recognized. Back in the 1970s and early 80s, it wasn't, but science now knows that it should be on the periodic table, but it isn't. It has the ability, and this was discovered, in fact, through heating and cooling processes in thermogravimetric analysis, it has the ability to change its weight. It will become immensely heavier than itself. It will actually weigh at certain high temperatures less than zero. It will levitate. It will actually disappear from sight totally, not become invisible, but it appears to actually move into a different space-time dimension. It can be brought back again. So it's potential in the world of modern science, and this is what I found intriguing when looking at ancient texts, was that what had been discovered there in America from the 1970s onwards, was really a very ancient technology based on this Firestone.
Lawrence,
now at the forefront of anti-gravity research and all sorts of things.
I was going to say, I mean, do people, in order to do this, do they ingest it? Do they drink it? Do they eat it?
It has all sorts of applications, it seems. I mean, the fact that it is superconductive is particularly interesting because it sort of completes the Ark of the Covenant story in one respect, in that although it's generally perceived and generally taught in churches and schools that the Ark of the Covenant contained the Ten Commandments, in fact, the story of the Ark of the Covenant is told in the Book of Exodus, and nowhere does it say that the Ten Commandments were placed in the Ark in the Book of Exodus. It says it contained the Testament. Now, what happens is that later on in the Book of Hebrews in the New Testament, St. Paul explains that it actually contained the manna. And he also refers to Aaron's rod. Now, Aaron's rod is an odd thing because it's never really discussed in the Bible. We don't know whether it was 6 inches long or 100 feet long. We have no idea what the rod is. And this is what seems to tie in with William's idea about this rod device. Now, the fact that the manna goes into the ark, and the ark, having been reconstructed on computer, turns out to be a very, very powerful electronic capacitor or condenser, it will become superconductive by the application of this material, this white powder. It will then have the power to levitate and do all sorts of extraordinary things. It can also become a powerful communications device, but it lacks that potential until something is added. And this is where William's theory could well proved to be the answer. It was said in ancient Babylonian texts, certainly in Egyptian texts, it's quite common, that the kings and the pharaohs, as they later became called in the Greek language, ingested this substance, this white powder. It was supposed to heighten their awareness, their perception, their intuition, the general qualities of attributed to leadership, really. Now, in modern science, it's actually been discovered that it does have an effect on the endocrinal glandular system, and it depends what metal the powder is made of, which gland it particularly affects. I mean, gold, for example, seems to affect the pineal gland in particular, so it's responsible for heightening melatonin production.
Right.
And in fact, as some people have recently put to me, it could very well be part of what's now being discussed, DMT, a sort of a spirit molecule that is due to open up unlock unused parts of the brain. Really, it seems to have a weird capacity. Iridium works on the pituitary gland and on serotonin production, and so we can see that what would have been happening in those times was that by ingesting these substances, they actually would have been increasing their hormonal secretions, and this would have given them these extra powers. But it said also that it has powers of longevity, anti-aging. Now, again, if we look at the world of modern science, the tests that were carried out through late 1980s and early 1990s, they were testing it over there in various centers for a possible cancer treatment, and it does seem to have the ability to react with DNA and to correct malformed DNA. Which, of course, is what cancer is. It's malformed cell structure.
Of course, my gosh, yeah.
So, you know, in the medical fields, it has all sorts of attributes. And being superconductive, being anti-gravitational, it's also, you know, being looked at in terms of space research and aerospace research.
Can it become toxic if you ingest too much of it?
Well, I mean, who knows? The fact is that, I mean, when one looks at metals themselves, I mean, there is no doubt that, you know, there is a problem with ingesting metals. You know, some of the heavy metals are particularly toxic. Well, we're not looking at those. We're looking at gold and platinum group metals. And I don't know that there's that much history of people sort of consuming lots of gold or platinum group metals in their raw state. The powder, of course, takes on a different form. You know, it doesn't know that it's metal anymore. It doesn't analyze as metal. Only under certain circumstances, a Russian technique will actually explain the metal that it derives from. But, I mean, the fact is that the ingestion courses that have been tried over the last few years have been very carefully monitored. We're dealing with very small doses of this stuff, you know, with volunteers who have been evaluating it, so to speak. And I mean, at the moment, there seems to be, and this is why I'm a little hesitant about the DMT thing, it seems to produce no psychedelic effect particularly. It seems to have no adverse or side effects as far as we can tell. But it does seem to have some of these anti-aging properties. You know, aging skin will tighten, sight has been known to improve, certainly monatomic copper is quite remarkable. This seems to actually have the ability to turn gray or graying hair back towards its original color, that sort of thing. So in terms of it being called a fountain of youth or some of the other names that were given to it in past times, it does seem to have those effects. But I mean, like anything, you know, one can get involved with too much water and drown. You know, everything's bad for you.
Exactly.
You know, with too much.